Welcome to the History Maps podcast. Let's look at a piece of solid granite. It is carved to look exactly like a multi-story skyscraper.
Right, complete with these false doors and intricate rows of windows.
Yeah, and this single block of stone weighs over 520 tons. It is longer than a modern 10-story building is tall.
And you have to consider that this is being hoisted into the sky by sheer human muscle and very rudimentary engineering.
Exactly. And then the earth gives way, the ropes snap, the entire monumental structure crashes to the ground, shattering into massive fragments.
And it just lies there for millennia. That broken colossus is still sitting in the highlands of present-day northern Ethiopia.
It is the physical remnant of a state that the 3rd-century Persian prophet Mani ranked as one of the 4 great powers of the known world.
Right. He looked at the globe and he listed Babylon, Rome, China, and a 4th name that, while rarely makes it into modern conversations about ancient global superpowers.
The Kingdom of the Aksumites.
Yeah. And the inclusion of Aksum on that list completely reframes our understanding of global networks in late antiquity.
We are going to examine the entire life cycle of this empire today, from its indigenous agro-pastoral roots all the way to its environmental and economic collapse.
Because the sources we have, like the archaeological field reports and the numismatic databases detailing currency flows, paint a picture of a state that was far more than just a localized African kingdom.
Right. We will also be looking at ancient mercantile texts, like the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea.
Exactly. It shows this was an essential cosmopolitan hub. I mean, Aksum projected power across the Red Sea and held a virtual monopoly on international trade between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean.
Plus, they built an infrastructure capable of sustaining a massive population in a really unforgiving environment.
Right. And to understand the ancient global economy, you really have to dissect the mechanics of how Aksum operated.
So to understand how they monopolized those trade routes, we have to start with how they survived their geography.
Yeah, the core territory of what becomes Aksum is situated in the rugged highlands of the Tigray region.
And if we look at the landscape around the 10th century BCE, it is intensely dramatic.
Oh, absolutely. You are dealing with steep escarpments and deep river valleys.
And a high plateau sitting over 2,000 meters above sea level. I mean, the air is thinner, the terrain is rocky, and the rainfall is highly seasonal.
It is not the sort of place that naturally lends itself to the agricultural surpluses you need to build an empire.
Right, so the topography basically demanded severe innovation.
Yeah, a growing population simply cannot survive at that altitude without completely re-engineering the landscape.
So the early communities in this region developed highly complex terrace farming.
And this isn't just about, you know, digging a few steps into a hill. Building an agricultural terrace requires massive intergenerational communal labor.
Because they had to construct extensive dry stone retaining walls right along the contours of these steep escarpments.
Exactly. And those walls served a dual purpose. First, they created flat, arable plots of land out of sheer cliffs.
And second, which is probably more important, they managed the mechanics of water runoff.
Right. During the intense seasonal rains, the water would otherwise just strip the thin highland topsoil right off the mountain.
So the terraces slowed the water down, it allowed it to percolate into the soil, and prevented catastrophic erosion.
It is essentially terraforming on a massive scale.
And the crops they were planting on these terraces were uniquely adapted to this specific biome. The sources heavily feature the cultivation of teff.
Right. For anyone unfamiliar, teff is an indigenous cereal grass. The grains are incredibly tiny-like, about the size of a poppy seed.
But they pack a massive nutritional punch, and it is highly resilient to both waterlogging and drought.
Which means it can survive those erratic climate swings of the high plateau.
So you have communities cultivating teff, managing herds of cattle on the rocky slopes, and eventually integrating Near Eastern crops like barley and lentils.
Yeah, they engineered an agricultural engine that produced the caloric surplus necessary to support specialized labor.
Because you need that excess food before you can have full-time stonemasons or soldiers or kings.
Exactly. And that caloric surplus fueled the emergence of a centralized pre-Aksumite polity known as the Kingdom of DMT.
Which was centered around a site called Yeha, located to the northeast of the eventual capital of Aksum.
Right. And when archaeologists began excavating Yeha, they encountered a very specific set of material culture that puzzled early historians.
Because alongside the indigenous artifacts, there was a sudden appearance of South Arabian influences.
Specifically from the Sabaean civilization, which was located directly across the Red Sea in what is now Yemen.
Okay, let's unpack this. The centerpieces at Yehar are monumental structures, like a massive dry stone temple dating to around the 8th century BCE.
Yeah, and you also find stone altars and inscriptions utilizing the ancient South Arabian script.
Now, my immediate instinct when I see foreign monumental architecture and a foreign script suddenly appearing in an indigenous landscape is to assume some form of colonial takeover.
And older theories suggested exactly that. They argued that Sabaeans sailed across the Red Sea, subjugated the local population, and built this civilization from the ground up.
But did people from South Arabia just sail over and build it from scratch?
No, the modern archaeological record dismantling that diffusionist theory is quite comprehensive.
Right, because if a foreign power colonizes a region, you expect to see their material culture permeate the daily lives of the general population.
Exactly. But when archaeologists look away from the elite ceremonial center of Yehar and excavate rural, non-elite sites, the story changes completely.
The site of Mesber is the perfect example of this.
Yeah, if you read the excavation reports from Mesber, it shows continuous habitation going back to 1600 BCE.
And the South Arabian influence there is virtually non-existent.
Right. The people there were using indigenous ceramic traditions. They were manufacturing local lithic tools.
Specifically, those specialized stone scrapers used for processing animal hides.
Exactly. There is no South Arabian masonries in their homes and no South Arabian script on their pottery.
So if this were a true colonization, the domestic sphere would definitely reflect it.
It would. The data actually points to strategic cultural synthesis rather than colonization.
Meaning the Sabaean influence was strictly confined to the elite echelons of society.
Right. The local rulers in Diem, who took on the title of Mukarib, were engaging with the broader Red Sea world.
And to enhance their own prestige and facilitate international trade, they adopted the symbols of the dominant commercial power of their day.
Yeah, they utilized the South Arabian script for their monumental inscriptions and integrated foreign deities like the god Aftar into their pantheon.
It functions exactly like corporate branding.
That is a great way to put it. If a local elite wants to signal they are a legitimate player in the international market, they adopt the visual and linguistic markers of that market.
So rather than a conquest, we are looking at centuries of intense interaction and blending.
Yes. The local Cushitic-speaking Aga populations are interacting with Semitic-speaking groups.
And over time, this generates the Ethio-Semitic language family.
Specifically, the language of Giz emerges, and that will become the administrative and liturgical voice of the Aksumite state.
So this deep integration of indigenous resilience and strategic foreign interaction creates a highly distinct, localized culture.
Right. By the late 1st millennium BCE, the kingdom of DMT begins to fragment.
The political center of gravity shifts westward.
Yeah, we see a transition phase where a major settlement develops on a hill called Beta Georgis,
which sits just to the northwest of the lower plains where the city of Aksum will eventually be built.
Exactly. During this proto-Aksumite period, they refine their agricultural output, build massive elite residences, and consolidate regional power.
And by the 1st century CE, the settlement expands down into the plains, laying the foundation for the imperial capital.
But, you know, domestic farming does not put you on a list with Rome and China.
Right. We have established how they generated local wealth. But to understand the sheer scale of Aksum's wealth, we have to pull our focus away from the highland terraces.
We have to look sharply eastward, toward the coast. The economic engine of this empire was the Red Sea.
Because the Red Sea functioned as the central artery of global commerce in late antiquity.
It was the bottleneck. All the wealth of the Indian Ocean flowed into the Mediterranean through it.
And Aksum systematically positioned itself to control the most vital node on that route.
That node was the port city of Adulis, situated on the western shore of the Red Sea in modern-day Eritrea.
And we have a highly detailed administrative document from the 1st century CE that maps out exactly how this port functioned.
Right. It is a Greco-Roman merchant's manual called the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea.
It was essentially a practical navigational and commercial guide for traders operating out of Roman Egypt.
And the author explicitly names the ruler of the Aksumite region, King Zoscalus. He describes Adulis as a legally established open harbor.
The Periplus serves as a ledger for the ancient economy. It details the precise flow of goods.
Yeah, the exports leaving Adulis were primarily luxury raw materials extracted from the African interior.
The text lists massive quantities of ivory, and that required immense logistical networks.
You have to hunt elephants, process the tusks, and transport them from the deep interior all the way to the coast.
They also exported locally mined gold, tortoise shells, rhinoceros horns, and highly sought-after aromatics like frankincense.
The mechanics of the frankincense trade alone require vast localized knowledge.
Yeah, you have to locate the specific boswellia trees in the arid coastal regions.
Right. Score the bark at precise times of the year, allow the resin to bleed out and harden into tears,
and then harvest and transport it without degrading the quality. It's a highly specialized industry.
And in exchange for these raw materials, the Periplus details the imports pouring into Adulis.
You see silk from Han China, Indian spices, specifically pepper iron tools, and Roman manufactured goods like glassware and wine.
But Aksum's role was far more active than simply producing local goods for export.
They mastered the geography of the trade routes to extract wealth from goods they didn't even produce.
To grasp how they managed this, we need to look at the physical mechanics of ancient maritime navigation.
Right, because around the first century BCE, sailors fully decoded the pattern of the monsoon winds.
And the monsoon is essentially a massive meteorological conveyor belt.
Because of the way the Asian landmass heats and cools relative to the ocean, it creates a seasonal pressure vacuum.
Exactly. So for half the year, the winds blow steadily from the southwest, pushing ships from the Red Sea straight across the open ocean to India.
And then the winds reverse. They blow from the northeast, pushing ships back toward Africa.
Before they understood this open ocean crossing, ships had to painstakingly hug the coastlines of Arabia and Persia.
Which was a journey that took exponentially longer and was totally vulnerable to coastal piracy and numerous local tolls.
Yeah. Mastering the monsoon allowed for direct, high-volume shipping.
However, a ship traveling from Roman Egypt to India couldn't make the entire journey in one continuous push.
Right. They had to wait for the winds to shift.
So Adulis, with its deep water harbor and access to highland resources, became the mandatory layover point.
Merchants would arrive in Adulis and be effectively trapped there for months, waiting for the seasonal wind reversal.
Which turns the port into a captive market. The Aksumite state didn't just trade, they taxed the layover.
Yeah, they levied tariffs on the ships docking in the harbor, taxed the goods being unloaded, and taxed the supplies the merchants needed to survive while they waited.
It's the equivalent of controlling the primary toll booth on the only highway between two massive economies.
And beyond the maritime choke point, Aksum executed a brilliant maneuver regarding overland logistics.
Historically, the Kingdom of Kush, situated in modern-day Sudan, held a monopoly on African goods.
Right, they controlled the Nile Corridor, funneling ivory and gold northward into Egypt.
But Aksum intentionally bypassed this older network.
Yeah. By securing the Highland Passes and establishing protected caravan routes straight to the Red Sea, they redirected the wealth of the African interior eastward to Adulis.
They physically starved the Kingdom of Kush of its primary revenue stream.
By rerouting the trade, Aksum guaranteed that if the Roman Empire wanted African ivory or gold, they had to buy it through an Aksumite middleman at an Aksumite port.
This level of economic control radically transformed the demographic makeup of Adulis.
Oh, absolutely. You have Roman, Greek, Egyptian, Syrian, Persian, and Indian merchants all living side by side in this coastal city for months at a time.
And the necessity of managing this diverse population created a heavily bilingual society.
The indigenous population utilized Ge'ez, but Greek functioned as the absolute lingua franca of the Red Sea trade.
In fact, the Periplus explicitly notes that King Zoskelis was educated in Greek literature.
And this wasn't a matter of cultural deference. It was a highly pragmatic business strategy.
Right. To negotiate treaties, draft trade agreements, and enforce tariffs with their primary trading partners in the Roman and Byzantine worlds, the Aksumite administration had to operate flawlessly in Greek.
But managing a globalized high-volume economy requires more than a shared language.
Yeah. If you have an Indian merchant trying to buy Roman glass with Chinese silk while paying an Aksumite tariff, a simple barter system mathematically collapses under its own weight.
You need a standardized medium of exchange.
You need a state-backed currency.
Mm-hmm.
And Aksum is the only sub-Saharan African state in antiquity to develop one.
The introduction of standardized coinage is the definitive marker of a state transitioning into a fully integrated imperial economy.
In 270, King Endibis issued the first Aksumite coins.
And this was a calculated implementation of a trimetallic system utilizing gold, silver, and bronze.
The physical mechanics of ancient minting alone are complex. You have to mine the ore, refine the metal to a consistent purity, cast blank metal planchets.
Right, and then strike them between two engraved iron or bronze dies using a heavy hammer to imprint the king's image.
It requires intense state infrastructure just to produce the physical objects.
But the economic theory behind the coins is even more compelling. King Endebis minted his gold coins at a very specific weight.
Approximately 2.7 grams.
And that specific weight reveals their geopolitical strategy. 2.7 grams aligned exactly with the Roman half-aureus standard.
Meaning the Aksumites were intentionally pegging their currency to the Mediterranean economy.
Exactly. Later, in 296, the Roman Emperor Diocletian enacted sweeping monetary reforms to combat inflation.
He introduced a new gold standard called the solidus.
And Aksum immediately recalibrated its mints. They adjusted the weight of their gold coins to match the solidus standard, settling at around 2.25 grams.
Because pegging a currency means you are guaranteeing that your money is directly convertible to the dominant global reserve currency at a fixed rate.
Right. When an Aksumite merchant handed a gold coin to a Byzantine trader, the trader didn't have to weigh it or question its value. The weight standard spoke for itself.
But the linguistic choices on the coins are deeply revealing about who exactly the state was speaking to.
Because the gold coins are stamped entirely with Greek inscriptions.
You see phrases like Endebis, King of the Aksumites, written in the Mediterranean lingua franca.
But the silver and bronze coins, minted at the exact same time, use the local Gaius script.
The linguistic divide reflects a sophisticated understanding of macro and microeconomics.
Yeah, gold was the metal of international diplomacy and high-level maritime trade. A gold coin was designed to leave the empire.
So by stamping it in Greek, the Aksumite king was projecting sovereignty to foreign powers.
It signaled that Aksum possessed the wealth, the state infrastructure, and the refined metallurgy to stand as an equal peer to Rome or Persia.
And the silver and bronze coins were designed to stay at home.
Right. Base metals facilitated the domestic market. They allowed a highland farmer to come into the city and sell grain for a few bronze coins.
Rather than trying to barter a cow for a plowshare, it monetized the local economy.
And by using gaze on the domestic currency, the state turned the money into a mass communication tool.
Because a coin is a piece of state ideology that a citizen carries in their pocket.
Exactly. Every time they conducted a transaction, they looked at the profile of their king. It reinforced the authority of the central government.
And the geographic distribution of these coins proves the effectiveness of the system.
We have archaeological reports detailing hoards of Aksumite gold coins discovered in southern India.
And others found in the Mediterranean port city of Caesarea.
For a currency to circulate thousands of miles away from the mint that struck it, it requires absolute trust in the issuing authority.
And that trust was built on metallurgical integrity.
Mm-hmm.
Assays of ancient Aksumite coins demonstrate that kings like Aphilus maintained a gold purity of over 90%.
The 6th century merchant and writer Cosmas Indicalpleistes noted in his text that the Aksumite state maintained a strict monopoly on gold mining.
By controlling the supply of raw gold and refusing to debase the currency by mixing in cheaper metals, they controlled inflation.
Yeah, a trusted, pure gold coin gave Aksum immense economic leverage in foreign markets.
So the empire is operating a massive monetized trade network, communicating with the Mediterranean, Greek, and with its own people in gaze.
But these coins tell us more than just economic history. They are a visual timeline of a massive ideological shift.
Right. If you look at the early coins minted by Endebis, the space above the king's head features specific religious symbols.
A disc and a crescent.
But as we move into the middle of the 4th century, those symbols are entirely erased from the dies.
And they are replaced by the Christian cross.
To understand the gravity of that change, we have to look at the pre-Christian theology that governed the state.
And the physical monuments they built to honor it.
The physical manifestation of that earlier theology is located in the central stele field in the capital city of Aksum.
Which is a necropolis for the royal elite. It is marked by these massive monoliths carved from solid syenite granite.
The engineering required to create these stele is staggering. I mean, how do you quarry granite without explosives or powered machinery?
Well, the stonemasons would have to find a solid bedrock seam and then carve deep grooves into the granite.
Then they drive dry wooden wedges tightly into the grooves.
Exactly. And then they soaked the wood with water. As the wood expanded, the sheer physical force of the swelling timber would split the bedrock.
And then they had to move a 500-ton block of stone across uneven terrain.
Using only wooden rollers, hemp ropes, and thousands of laborers pulling in unison.
Once at the site, the carving was meticulous. They shaped the monoliths to replicate domestic Aksumite architecture.
Yeah, the base features a carved false door, complete with a representation of a metal lock.
Above the door are vertical columns of false windows.
And they're separated by horizontal bands that mimic the timber beams used in actual building construction. It is a style known as monkey head architecture.
So they were building houses for the dead out of single pieces of stone.
Right. And erecting a 33-meter, 520-ton monolith requires a masterclass in physics.
You have to dig a massive foundation pit lined with structural support stones, drag the base of the steel to the edge,
and use earthen ramps, massive A-frame timber scaffolds, and complex pulley systems acting as fulcrums to slowly pull the stone upright
until it drops into the slot. And the largest of these steelies proves how close to the edge of physical possibility they were operating.
Because that 33-meter steel lies shattered on the ground.
The archaeological evidence suggests it fell during the attempt to erect it. The foundation was unable to handle the immense localized weight, bringing the entire structure down in a catastrophic failure.
These monuments were the anchor of a deeply entrenched polytheistic system.
The royal inscriptions from the 3rd century provide a clear picture of the theology. The pantheon was dominated by Maram, the god of war.
The Aksumite kings claimed direct divine descent from Maram. They framed their military victories as the will of this deity.
And alongside Maram was Astar, a celestial god of heaven, and Behur, the god of the sea and the earth.
The entire ideological structure of the state was built on the premise that the king's authority to tax, to conquer, and to build these massive monuments was granted by Maram.
So replacing the disc and crescent with the Christian cross was not a minor adjustment in court protocol.
No, it required dismantling the foundational myth of the empire.
This profound shift occurs during the reign of King Ezana, roughly between 330 and 360.
Aksum becomes the first major state outside the Roman Empire and the first in sub-Saharan Africa to officially declare itself Christian.
And the narrative of how this theological revolution begins involves an accidental arrival.
The historical texts recount the story of a Syrian boy named Frumentius.
According to the historian Rufinus, Frumentius and his brother Odysseus were traveling down the Red Sea with their uncle, who was a philosopher and merchant.
And their ship docked at a port on the African coast.
Depending on the source, the ship was either attacked by pirates or local authorities seized the vessel in retaliation for a suspended Roman trade treaty.
Either way, the crew and the uncle were killed, but the two boys were spared due to their youth and taken as captives to the Aksumite royal court.
It is a brutal origin story, but Frumentius leverages his Mediterranean education to survive.
Right. He rises from a captive to a trusted administrative clerk,
eventually becoming a close advisor to the royal family and the personal tutor to the crown prince, Ezana.
So when Ezana ascends to the throne, Frumentius is deeply embedded in the power structure.
He travels north to Alexandria in Egypt, meets with the powerful patriarch Athanasius, and is officially consecrated as the first bishop of Aksum.
And he returns with the institutional backing of the Alexandrian church to formally organize the new faith within the empire.
Now, what does this all mean? Did Ezana convert solely out of personal conviction, or was this a calculated geopolitical maneuver?
Well, the personal influence of Frumentius on Ezana's theological development is undeniable, but analyzing imperial conversions solely through the lens of personal faith ignores the massive geopolitical machinery at work.
Right, because in the early 4th century, the Roman Empire under Constantine the Great had decriminalized Christianity.
And was actively integrating it into the state apparatus.
Rome is Aksum's largest client.
Yeah.
The Byzantine markets are the primary destination for the ivory, gold, and frankincense flowing through Adulis.
If your most vital trading partner suddenly shifts their entire religious and legal framework, adapting to that shift is a matter of national security and economic survival.
So by adopting Christianity, Ezana aligned his empire with the Byzantine superpower.
It was an incredibly astute diplomatic maneuver. Sharing a state religion smoothed the friction of international trade.
It allowed Aksumite diplomats to negotiate with Byzantine officials as religious peers rather than pagan outsiders.
Furthermore, it solidified a massive military and political alliance against their mutual rival, the Sasanian Persian Empire,
which controlled the overland routes to the east.
Ezana utilized the state mint to broadcast this new alliance to the world. He permanently stamped the cross onto his gold coins to signal that Aksum was now a pillar of the Christian bloc.
And the adoption of Christianity triggered a secondary revolution, one that fundamentally altered the mechanics of the Ge's language.
Right, when a state adopts a text-based religion, they need to be able to read the foundational documents.
The Bible and various theological texts were written in Greek and Syriac.
But early Ge's was an Abjadah script consisting entirely of consonants. There were no vowels.
Now, if you were reading a commercial ledger, consonants are fine. The context tells you what the word is.
But in theology, a single misinterpreted vowel can result in a massive doctrinal heresy.
So to accurately translate the nuances of Christian scripture, the Aksumite scribes had to engineer a solution.
They transformed the Ge's script into a fully vocalized system known as an abugida.
They modified the physical shape of the consonant characters, adding small strokes, loops, or altering the angle of the letter to indicate the specific vowel sound attached to it.
It is an incredible linguistic achievement. It allowed for hyper-accurate translation and sparked a massive literary movement.
The state sponsored the translation of the Bible and various apocryphal texts into Ge's.
This literary foundation institutionalized the Ethiopian Orthodox Tewahedo Church,
embedding the religion so deeply into the culture that it would eventually outlive the political state that created it.
But before the state collapsed, this religious alignment with the Byzantine Empire was going to pull Aksumum into one of the largest intercontinental conflicts of late antiquity.
The religious consolidation under Izana in the 4th century set the stage for massive power projection in the 6th century.
Right. Aksum had already secured its western flank. Decades earlier, Izana's armies had marched inland, systematically dismantling the remnants of the Kingdom of Kush.
And destroying its capital at Maro. This secured total dominance over the African interior.
But the true test of their imperial capacity was going to take place across the water.
In the region of Himyar, located in modern-day Yemen.
Yeah, the geopolitical map in the early 6th century is a powder keg. It operates much like a Cold War scenario.
You have two massive superpowers, the Christian Byzantine Empire and the Zoroastrian Sasanian Persian Empire, locked in a struggle for global hegemony.
And rather than always fighting directly, they often engage in proxy wars.
Manipulating local regional powers to control vital trade corridors. And the most valuable corridor on Earth was the southern entrance to the Red Sea,
which controlled the flow of Indian Ocean's silk and spices.
The crisis ignites in the 520s. A leader named Du Nuwes violently seizes the throne in Himyar.
Du Nuwes had converted to Judaism. And in an effort to consolidate his power and root out Byzantine influence, he initiated a brutal purge of the local Christian populations.
The most infamous event was a massive siege and subsequent massacre of the Christian community in the city of Najran.
This action severely disrupted the regional balance of power. It threatened Aksum's merchant fleets operating in Arabian ports.
And it gave the Christian alliance a massive ideological casus belli.
So the Byzantine emperor, Justin I, essentially reaches out to the Aksumite king, Caleb,
and urges him to act as the sword of the Christian world.
Justin offers diplomatic support and transport vessels, but it is Caleb who has to execute the war.
The logistics of King Caleb's response are staggering. Organizing an amphibious invasion requires an unfathomable amount of resources.
The historical chronicles claim Caleb assembled a fleet of 60 ships and an army of 120,000 troops.
We have to pause and critically evaluate those numbers. Ancient historians routinely inflate troop counts for dramatic effect.
Right, because if you have 60 ships and 120,000 men, you are putting 2,000 men on a single ancient transport vessel.
Which is physically impossible. Even if we drastically reduce the number to 10 or 20,000 troops, the sheer volume of supplies required is immense.
You have to load the ships with enough fresh water for thousands of men, secure fodder for the cavalry horses, and stockpile grain to sustain the army upon landing.
Moving even 10,000 soldiers across the Red Sea is a logistical miracle.
Regardless of the exact troop count, the military operation was devastatingly effective. Caleb's forces successfully crossed the sea, established a beachhead, and engaged the Himyarite army.
Du Nuwes was killed in the fighting, and the Aksumite forces captured the capital city, seizing control of the entire southwestern Arabian Peninsula.
This victory in the 520s is the absolute peak of the Aksumite Empire.
If you look at the map at this exact moment, they control the high plateau of the Horn of Africa, the deep water ports of the Western Red Sea, the caravan routes deep into the interior.
And now, the entire Arabian coastline opposite them. They have effectively placed a chokehold on the gateway between the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean.
To manage this massive overseas territory, King Caleb leaves a garrison force and installs a local Christian viceroy named Sumiafa Ashua to govern on his behalf.
But projecting power across an ocean is vastly different from maintaining it.
Yeah, the supply lines are slow, and the local Arabian factions remain highly fractured and resistant to foreign occupation.
The system breaks down almost immediately. A portion of the Aksumite garrison mutinies.
They overthrow the viceroy and elevate one of Caleb's own generals, a man named Abraha, to power.
And Abraha declares himself an independent king of Himyar.
Caleb is forced to send a secondary expeditionary force across the sea to crush the rebellion, but Abraha's forces defeat them.
The two sides eventually grind to a stalemate and agree to a pragmatic truce.
Abraha acknowledges the nominal suzerainty of Aksum and pays a tribute, but he operates with complete autonomy.
Even with this internal schism, the cultural and political weight of Aksum in Arabia remains massive under Abraha.
He rules for decades, engaging in massive building projects, including a grand cathedral in Sana'a designed to rival the Kaaba in Mecca as a pilgrimage site.
And in 547, Abraha hosts a major international diplomatic conference.
Envoys from the Byzantine Emperor, from Sasanian Persia, and from various nomadic Arab confederations all travel to Sana'a to negotiate with him.
It highlights that the Aksumite presence in Arabia, even under a rogue general, was a central pillar of global diplomacy.
But the Sasanian-Persian Empire is not going to tolerate an allied proxy of Rome controlling their southern flank indefinitely.
No, the Persians understood that they could not defeat the Aksumites in a naval battle on the Red Sea. They lacked the maritime infrastructure in that specific theater.
So they engineered a highly specialized overland and coastal counterattack utilizing advanced military technology.
In the 570s, the Persian Emperor Khosrow I receives an appeal from a disenfranchised Himyarite nobleman named Sa'i ibn Diyazan,
who requests military aid to expel the Aksumites.
Khosrow agrees, but rather than sending his primary field army, he dispatches a highly specialized, expendable expeditionary force.
The chronicles describe this force as an army of 800 prisoners, commanded by an elite general named Juarez.
It reads like a suicide mission sending prisoners into a foreign theater.
But these were likely political prisoners, highly trained, disgraced soldiers, dispatched on a fleet of ships down the Persian Gulf and along the southern coast of Arabia.
When Juarez's forces link up with the local Arabian rebels, they engage the Aksumite army, which was now commanded by Abraha's son, Masruk.
And the decisive factor in this engagement was a piece of Sasanian military technology called the Panjigan.
The sources describe the Panjigan as a mechanical device capable of firing a volley of arrows simultaneously.
We are likely talking about a heavy mounted crossbow mechanism that requires multiple men or a winch to draw back.
Yeah, imagine standing in an ancient infantry line. You are used to seeing a man draw a bow and fire a single arrow.
Suddenly, the enemy deploys a machine that fires five heavy armor-piercing bolts at once with terrifying kinetic force.
The psychological shock alone would break a formation.
And the physical reality of the battle was entirely dictated by this technology.
According to the chronicler Al-Tabari, General Juarez utilized the Panjigan to target the Aksumite leadership directly.
He fired a bolt that struck Masruk squarely, killing the king on the field.
The sudden decapitation of the leadership, combined with the terror of the mechanical volley fire, routed the Aksumite army.
The Sasanian forces systematically captured the cities and expelled the Aksumite administration from the Arabian Peninsula permanently.
They lose their overseas territory, and the Persians install a vassal king, eventually annexing Yemen directly into the Sasanian Empire.
The loss of Arabia in the 570s is the fracture point. It shatters the illusion of Aksumite invincibility.
But empires rarely collapse from a single military defeat.
Right. The loss of Yemen was just the first trigger in a cascading series of economic, geopolitical, and environmental disasters that would eventually dismantle the state entirely.
The Persians recognized that simply holding Yemen was not enough. They had to sever Aksum's economic lifeline.
So following their victory, the Sasanian navy established a strict blockade of the Red Sea.
They aggressively pushed across the water and occupied the Dalak Archipelago, a chain of islands sitting dangerously close to the Aksumite coast.
And by controlling those islands, the Persian ships could physically intercept and block the trade routes.
If a merchant vessel tried to sail from Adulis to India, the Sasanian navy would seize it. They systematically choked off the flow of luxury goods.
Aksum lost its access to the Indian Ocean markets, which meant the massive tariff revenue that funded the empire evaporated almost overnight.
And while Aksum is suffocating under the Persian blockade, a completely unprecedented geopolitical force erupts from the Arabian desert in the 7th century.
the Islamic caliphates.
Yeah. The speed and scale of the early Islamic expansion radically alter the map of the world.
Within a few decades, Arab armies push north and west. They conquer Egypt and Syria, entirely severing the Byzantine Empire from the Red Sea.
They push east and completely destroy the Sasanian-Persian Empire.
The two massive superpowers that Aksum had built its entire foreign policy around are either crippled or annihilated.
Now, the initial interaction between the Aksumite state and the early Muslims was actually characterized by mutual respect.
Right. During the early days of Islam, when the Prophet Muhammad and his followers were facing severe persecution in Mecca, Muhammad instructed a group of his followers to seek refuge across the sea in the Christian kingdom of Aksum.
This event is known as the First Hijra. The Aksumite king, referred to in Islamic sources as the Najashi, granted them asylum and protected them from their Meccan pursuers.
Because of this historical sanctuary, the early Islamic caliphates generally avoided direct military aggression against the core Aksumite territories.
They didn't launch massive invasions into the highlands, but economically, the rise of the caliphates was fatal.
Okay, let's unpack this. Was it the Persians, the Muslims, or the climate that actually broke Aksum?
It was a catastrophic convergence of all three. What's fascinating here is that the caliphates didn't need to conquer Aksum. They simply rendered it obsolete.
As the Islamic Empire consolidated control over the Middle East and the Red Sea coast, they established and prioritized their own maritime infrastructure.
Right. They routed trade through ports further north, specifically Jeddah, which served the holy city of Mecca.
The global shipping lanes shifted. Merchant vessels sailed directly past Adulis without stopping.
This is the death blow to a middleman economy. If the global highway is rerouted, your toll booth becomes worthless.
When we look at the physical evidence of this economic starvation, it is stark. By the early 7th century, the Aksumite state completely ceases the production of coinage.
And the cessation of the mint is a definitive indicator of systemic state failure.
Without the influx of foreign gold, the state cannot pay its administrators or fund a standing army.
The complex monetized economy collapses back into a localized barter system.
The central government loses the ability to project power or maintain the massive infrastructure required to hold the empire together.
And as the trade wealth vanishes, the urban populations can no longer rely on imported food.
The entire burden of feeding the empire falls back onto the highland agricultural terraces in Tigray.
And this is where the geopolitical collapse triggers an environmental catastrophe.
The highland ecosystem had been engineered to support a massive population, but it was not invincible.
For centuries, the Aksumite state had required immense quantities of iron for tools, weapons, and architectural brackets.
Iron smelting requires charcoal, and charcoal requires wood. Over centuries, they aggressively deforested the plateau to feed the furnaces.
The mechanics of deforestation on a steep incline are brutal. When you strip the trees, you kill the root systems that physically bind the soil to the bedrock.
Without the tree canopy to soften the impact of the rain, and without the roots to hold the earth, the intense seasonal monsoons batter the exposed ground.
Geoarchaeological studies, specifically the analysis of sediment and pollen cores extracted from local lakes, reveal a drastic shift in the environment during the 7th and 8th centuries.
The terraces, lacking the communal labor to maintain them, begin to fail.
The heavy rains strip the nutrient-rich topsoil, creating massive, deep gullies. The land is physically washed away.
The pollen data also indicates a period of severe aridification. The rainfall became erratic and sparse.
The land simply breaks. It can no longer produce the teff and barley needed to keep the population alive.
And a starving, bankrupt state cannot defend its borders. As the agricultural yield plummets, nomadic pastoralist groups from the eastern deserts, known as the Beja, begin pushing heavily into the northern territories of the empire.
They are looking for grazing land, and they overrun the degraded Aksumite farms. The state has no standing army left to repel them.
We can trace the physical retreat of the empire in the dirt. If you look at the excavations in the port city of Adulis, there is no evidence of a massive fiery destruction by a foreign army.
Instead, the grand stone basilicas and the international trading houses are slowly abandoned.
Over the decades, seasonal floods wash fluvial sands over the empty streets, literally burying the city.
Up in the highlands, the grand capital city of Aksum suffers a similar fate. The population, unable to feed itself, abandons the urban center.
The massive stone palaces fall into ruin. The giant stelae remains standing in a ghost town.
The remnants of the royal court and the political center of gravity are forced to retreat southward.
Deeper into the inaccessible mountains, away from the coast, and the encroaching Biha nomads.
Later Arabic sources refer to this diminished, isolated kingdom as being ruled from a new, much smaller capital called Kubar.
By the 8th and 9th centuries, the globally integrated coin-minting superpower is entirely gone.
It has regressed into a fragmented, highly isolated Christian kingdom struggling to survive in a degraded environment.
The political entity of the ancient Aksumite state officially collapses around 960.
Which was a chaotic period often attributed in local oral traditions to the destructive campaigns of a fierce queen named Gudit, who supposedly burned the remaining churches and eradicated the old royal line.
The political machinery of the empire was destroyed, but a civilization is more than just its tax revenue and its borders.
Right, the physical state died, but the cultural DNA it engineered proved incredibly resilient.
The legacy of Aksum survived the collapse.
The vocalized Ge'ez script remained the language of literature and theology.
The architectural techniques, the specific ways of carving stone and framing windows, were preserved.
And most crucially, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church survived as the unifying institution of the Highland people.
When the region eventually stabilizes and exits this localized dark age, the new powers explicitly reach back to Aksum for legitimacy.
In the 12th century, the Zegwi dynasty emerges. They're the ones who engineer the breathtaking rock-hewn churches of Lalibela,
carving massive structures straight down into the volcanic tuff.
And if you look at those churches, they are intentionally utilizing the exact same monkey head architectural motifs found on the Aksumite stele.
They are carving the memory of Aksumite into the bedrock.
Later, in 1270, the Solomonic dynasty takes power. And they justify their rule by tracing their bloodline directly through the ancient Aksumite kings all the way back to the biblical King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba.
The city of Aksum itself undergoes a profound metamorphosis. It ceases to be an imperial capital regulating global logistics.
And it transforms into a sacred space. It becomes a holy city, the absolute spiritual epicenter of Ethiopian Christianity.
According to the foundational national epic, the Kebra-Nagast, Aksum is the legendary resting place of the Ark of the Covenant.
Protected within the precincts of the Church of Our Lady Mary of Zion.
It is a remarkable journey. A city that built its wealth on taxing Indian pepper and Roman glassware evolves into the spiritual heart of millions.
It really is an incredible transformation.
Which leaves us with a final thought to consider. When we analyze the complete trajectory of Aksum, we see a society that leveraged geography to integrate itself into the absolute center of a globalized maritime network.
Their wealth, their gold currency, their cosmopolitan cities, it was all entirely dependent on being the indispensable middleman connecting two distinct worlds.
But it forces you to consider how a civilization's greatest strategic advantage can instantly become its fatal vulnerability. If a society engineers its entire existence around connecting other people's economies, what happens to that society when the rest of the world simply invents a new route and sails right past them? Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.